Dave Fanning on 2FM.
Now, you really can't expect a band or a solo artist to churn out an album a year or every 6 months like the production line the Beatles were on. But at the same time, with the pop market being so fickle with Flavour of the Month acts turning into Flavour of the Week, you can't really rest on your laurels either. You have to capitalise on the momentum, basically. Make the most of your moment or else you risk your fan base forgetting about you altogether. So if an act returns to the heights of musical success following a lengthy hiatus, it's all the more impressive. And to remind us then of some of those who did just that, we're joined by Jen Gannon. So Jen, how are you doing? Are you all right?
Hello.
Where do you want to start, Jen?
Anywhere. Let's
well, take
go.
That. What how about fancy? Take that?
Okay. Well, yeah, take that with patience. I think that was like one of the most surprising and deserved comebacks, I think everybody thought at the time, was Take That to Patience in 2006. And I know now we're all aware that Gary Barlow is a bit of a Tory and the other lads didn't pay their taxes. But at that time, the public had nothing but goodwill towards the band because they were just undoubtedly written off due to the domination of Robbie Williams in the 90s and the early 2000s. And Robbie had spun this narrative of, you know, Gary being the boring one and the others being, you know, no more than glorified backup dancers. You know, and kind of putting a spin on it that they weren't part altogether just part of this amazing, unique experience would Take That. So for a time, Robbie just rode the crest of a wave on the coattails of, you know, Guy Chambers, the songwriter. And he was part of that aftermath of Britpop and the Cool Britannia kind of buzz and that rise of lad culture. And he was a very safe junior kind of rock and roll star that your auntie could enjoy. And Take That were, you know, relegated to nothing more than this kind of teen memory that was maybe a little bit embarrassing. But then the thing to remember is you can't discount, you know, if you have a band that has a songwriter in it, and Take That never relied on someone else to write their songs because they had Gary Barlow. And Gary Barlow might not be the most interesting of people and he might not have set the world alight as a solo artist, but this was a man that wrote Back for Good, and that was this supremely adult song for a boy band to make at the time. So I think in the background, he was waiting for his audience to kind of mature along with him and then reconnect. And then they did this 10-year retrospective documentary and as a foursome without Robbie, and they could have easily relied on doing a nostalgia tour, but they decided to come out with this song, Patience, which Nicky Wire from the Manic Street Preachers has said is the greatest comeback single of all time.
The greatest comeback single of all time. Well, let's take a blast of that. This is Take That.
Have a little patience. Whoa.
Yeah, did huge stuff, all right. I wouldn't particularly be on the same page as Nicky Wire, but there you go. So from Patience, from, in other words, Take That, how about something completely different? We're talking comebacks here, look.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all, my empire of dirt,
So what are we looking at there, Jennifer? Johnny Cash.
Well, this is really when it comes into play. When you are a fan of somebody and you can give, you think you can give somebody a boost with doing something completely different with their career, that's when some magic can happen. And Rick Rubin, yeah, like the uber producer from Def Jam, who you'd know from producing, you know, the Beastie Boys, etc., and Public Enemy, he went on to found his a different record company, American Recordings, and was working with Johnny Cash because he knew his backstory and he knew exactly what he could do. And Johnny Cash's career was kind of not in the spotlight for a lot of the 80s. And then in the 90s, he really wanted to bring him back to prominence, but strip him down completely. And yeah, with something like that cover version of Nine Inch Nails Hurt, it is like he has taken ownership of that song completely. So not only was it a comeback song that introduced him to a whole new generation of people, it also gave that song a total different dynamic, and he kind of owned the song then, and it gave his career, just totally, yeah, changed his career, and also set a template for a lot of older artists. And you'll see a lot of older artists trying to do exactly what Johnny Cash did. Everyone from Tom Jones to Lulu, I suppose, are, yeah, trying to get that, claw that back. It's a very unique thing.
Okay, I don't know if you've seen the documentary that's out at the moment about Tina Turner, which really is very,
yes,
good. But one of the amazing things about the documentary is the fact that she was one of the biggest sellers of the 1980s. She was long gone from the 70s and all the rest of it. And when she came back, like, she was very old in so many ways to be a big, huge pop star. Tell me about that.
The thing about it is, as a woman in the music industry, you're not allowed to age. Basically, when you turn 30, you fall off the conveyor belt and there's some nubile 18-year-old, yeah, to replace you, and it has to happen. But with Tina, that was never going to happen. And as we know, if you've watched that documentary, it's absolutely stunning, and I recommend it to anybody.
Yeah,
like, she had such a hard scrabble life after leaving the marriage, the really just horrendous marriage to Ike. And she kind of just was living hand to mouth, and she ended up having this cleaning job to pay rent, and really then started to do cabaret shows a little bit in Las Vegas and get her confidence back. And it wasn't until, I think, in the 80s, at the start of the 80s, when she did a cover version of Ball of Confusion and by The Temptations, and she was signed again by Capitol Records. And then at the grand old age of 44, did a cover version of Let's Stay Together, Al Green's Let's Stay Together, and it became this surprise hit. And she found out that she did have an audience and people wanted Tina back and they wanted to hear her voice. And that led on to her actually doing an album of original work, and which gave us 1984's Private Dancer, which became, yeah, just a massive hit. And still to this day is such a classic song. And I think it just, not only, it felt like a different person. It wasn't Ike and Tina. This was Tina too.
Yeah, this was a serious reinvention. I'll just give you, yeah, a blast of one of the ones you mentioned there. So that became a huge success, and then Capitol Records wanted a full album, and then we got Private Dancer in 1984. So what about Whitney Houston, A Million Dollar Bill?
Well, Whitney, she had, her career had been written off completely at that point. So it's hard, that's hard to imagine now because we have her as this legend. But like, she'd released the album Just Whitney in 2002, and that really didn't do anything for her. And her performing and singing took a backseat with her whole turbulent private life and the headlines that were being made about her drug addiction issues and her marriage to Bobby Brown. And then she finally returned and gave us this sublime song, Million Dollar Bill, which was written by Alicia Keys, and it sampled Loretta Holloway. And it's just a reminder, it reminded everyone of how magical her voice was. As husky as it had become, it still sounded so unique and unbelievably powerful. And I think it was just a great song to unify her fans, but also just to reintroduce her to public life. And I think it'll also be remembered for this iconic performance on X Factor where the strap of her dress broke while she was singing live. And in typical Whitney fashion. She just took it in her stride. It was no wardrobe malfunction. She just told Dermot O'Leary after the performance that she just sung herself out of her dress. And that's how I love to remember Whitney, just as this really powerful voice.
Yeah, and that comeback wasn't real, was it? I mean, like, that was the end of it, really, wasn't it?
It was. I think it's her last great single before her death in 2012. And it really is difficult not to wonder what she would be doing now and who she would be working with,
well,
because I think she's so much left to give.
Yeah. Okay, that's Whitney Houston, and that's $1 Million Bill. And here's one now you can tell me about in a second or two that came completely out of the blue and number one towards the end of the 90s, and we hadn't heard from them in years.
Don't you want to take a
To me, it's not a patch on the stuff that made them famous, but it did get them right back up to number one after so many years. So tell me about that, Blondie and Maria.
Yeah, they hadn't released any new material since 1982's underwhelming The Hunter album.
Wow, really? Was it that long, yeah?
Yeah, well, that was it, yeah. I mean, so I had a whole lifetime of never having new Blondie music. And so then this in 1999, it just caught everybody off guard. And I think that the key about this is it's so easy as a band like Blondie just to rely on being a legacy act. And they did reform in 1997 to rehearse just to go on tour. But then they decided to start working on new material, which became the No Exit album, and they released Maria as their first single, and it became a piece of music history because, as you said, it went to number one here and it went to number one in the UK as well as several other European countries on its release. And I think they just became then this pan-generational kind of phenomenon, and it felt like one of those kind of moments that could only happen in pop music where the music is all that matters, and you know, all the listeners were just united by the fact that it's just a great song and they wanted to put it at the top of the charts.
Okay, well then where do you start and end with David Bowie?
Oh, well, that's the thing. I think David Bowie has had several comebacks during his lengthy career, and it felt like every time he released an album, somebody in a magazine or in the newspaper was saying it was being hailed as a comeback rather than him just motoring along and, you know, releasing material when he saw fit. But so where are we now? I mean, it isn't a traditional comeback, but it felt very momentous because he hadn't released any material since the Reality album in 2003, and it was thought that he'd kind of unofficially retired. And then Where Are We Now landed as this surprise release on his 66th birthday in 2011, and it was a very reflective mood. I was pondering over his time in Berlin, and that's not something he'd shared really before musically, because he's so forward thinking and so dynamic that he never really looks back. And it was new, but it felt like a nod to his past, and I think that's why people kind of responded to it in such a big way. And it was his biggest chart hit since Absolute Beginners in 1986, so it shouldn't really have been a revelation then to see that Bowie was being this meticulous artist with such creative control over his career, that he was really constructing his final act, with this being the beginning of the end, with the release date, with the themes, the presentation, with the sound, and then the connection between the Next Day album and the Black Star albums. He was trying to say goodbye. And I think Where Are We Now, it's not only a great comeback song, but it's a really beautiful reminder of everything that Bowie can symbolise as an artist.
The Next Day album, I think, was very overpraised myself, but this single was fantastic.
Where are we now?
20,000 people, Crosby's and Booker. Fingers are crossed, just in case. Walking the dead. Where are we now? Where are we now? The moment you know, you know.
Okay, where are we now? That is David Bowie, and we're talking about kind of comeback singles or comeback songs or whatever, and Jan Gannon it is. Now, I know you want to mention Lord, but seriously, I mean, like, you have to be, like, we're talking 20 years with a lot of these guys here. Like, we're talking 20 hours with Lord, are you?
This
you
is it.
Make I mean, the case.
No, well, I'm not even making the case. I'm very suspicious of this because it's really strange to me that, like, on, you know, social media and in a lot of websites, they were calling her new single Solar Power that was released in June a comeback. But I suppose it is in some ways because she hasn't released any material since Melodrama in 2017. And I think those 4 years of silence, they can be considered as some kind of trying to her reconnecting or getting together as an artist. Like, I mean, it did take the Stone Roses 5 years before they released The Second Coming. And that was, you know, such a big deal in the music press all the time. And now you think 5 years is nothing, I suppose. But with Lord, I think, because the gap wasn't between her first and second album, this is between her second and third album. So I think it's more of a natural break as an artist because she just needs stuff to write about. She needs to get inspired again. But it is it's a little bit of a different sound for her. It's more mellow, less electronic. So it'll be interesting to see if the rest of the album has this kind of tone. But I don't really think it's a comeback.
Okay, I'll give it a quick blast then.
Acid green, aquamarine. The girls are dancing in the sand, and I throw my cellular device in the water. Can you reach me? No. Can't.
Okay, we can only call it a bit of a comeback. Now here's a bit of a big one. Listen to this. She did use the old auto-tune well, but by God, did she use the old auto-tune.
She did, and there is a Netflix documentary called This Is Pop, which is really interesting, and one of the episodes is about auto-tune, yeah. And the producer, I believe, is talking about how they left it in. They didn't, like, refine the auto-tune, so you can totally hear it as a kind of effect on her voice, and a lot of musicians were really upset with Cher because they're saying, you're letting the cat out of the bag. What are you doing? Like, so I thought that was really interesting, and they lied for a long time saying, actually, it's a vocoder, but it wasn't. It was auto-tune, and the thing about it is you can never discount Cher, and that's why I absolutely adore her. Like, at that time, she hadn't had a hit since 1991, which was, like, Mermaids, I think, when she did a cover version of It's In Its Kiss. And then she'd released an album in 1995, which was cover versions called It's A Man's World. And that really wasn't setting the world alight for a lot of people other than Cher fans. So she went back and kind of looked around, like all the great artists, pop artists do, like Madonna and Kylie, and kind of was like synthesizing what is it that people are into these days, and looked at Britney Spears and looked at, you know, Brandy and Monica, and said, I want that kind of sound. I want to do that. And that tenacity of also, like, wanting to change your style, change your sound. A lot of female artists get grief for that, but then nobody ever says that when it's a heritage act like Bob Dylan or Neil Young. They're all, like, artists exploring themselves, whereas with someone like, it's always done in a cynical, viewed in a cynical way for someone like Cher or Madonna. But I think Cher really put it up to them, and I think Believe is just such a massive, such a great song that you can do
okay,
in any kind
of genre.
Let's
try this, completely different again.
Come too far to give up who we are. So let's raise the bar.
Get lucky it is, Daft Punk. Well, Jen.
Well, I wouldn't really consider that a comeback either in the traditional sense, because Daft Punk were still massive. I think it was more the fact that America had gotten into EDM between the time of Human After All, the last Daft Punk album, and then Random Access Memory, and they caught up with Europe, and then Daft Punk and this song featuring Nile Rodgers and Pharrell, that was met with this kind of eager anticipation, and that's why it seemed like a comeback, because it became such a global
success.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, then how about this as the final one then? Listen to this. So Back in Black, AC/DC, was that a comeback as such, or was it just a bizarre reinvention?
I just think it's when a band member dies or is not a part of the band anymore, like you see, you know, Joy Division or even with the Manic Street Preachers, you have to make that decision of whether or not you're going to change the band completely or keep the name and do something different or just disappear. And they did reconvene after Bon Scott died and decided to carry on with Brian Johnson. And amazingly, with Back in Black, it just became this massive hit for them. And it, like in that way with the Manic Street Preachers and A Design for Life, it was a reinvention of the same band rather than a Joy Division, New Order change completely.
Exactly, it really was. And listen, time's run out. So Jennifer, thanks a million. Jen Gannon it is. Thanks for talking to us on the programme today.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.